Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to the grand finale of the first season of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby.
And together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll also uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in. It's the season finale of the very first season of the Dolls podcast.
It's crazy.
I can't believe we've been doing this for half a year now.
Me neither.
It feels like we just started the other week.
Yes.
Clearly that's not the case because we've learned how to edit in that time. We've come a long way in such a short time and I'm so proud
of
us.
We really did. I feel like we shaped this really raw idea into something so beautiful. It's come together so greatly. We are gonna go on a little break after this one for a couple of months. We'll be back early next year, but we didn't want it to leave without giving you a little something special. So we decided to do another episode where we just answer all of your questions. So as you are hearing this, just go over to our Instagram. We will do
at the Dolls Pod.
Yes. Thanks for mentioning that. We will do a question sticker on our stories, but if you're running a little late and you're listening to this a little later, you can always comment under every post. It doesn't matter. We'll see it and we will try to answer all of your questions in that little fun laid-back episode. For a final time this year, take it away, Abby.
All right. I've said before that I'm not so much a music critic or rock historian as I am a failed artist. I went to art school, I studied art history, but that path just wasn't working out for me. Thankfully, as that life path was actively failing, I discovered rock and roll and the wonderful world of groupies. It might seem strange, but would you believe me if I told you groupie history and art history overlapped? We're here to tell you yes, it did overlap, and that very special intersection won my heart. As soon as Emma invited me to host this show with her, I knew who I wanted to devote an episode to. Our final doll of the first season of the Dolls podcast is the legendary Cynthia Plastercaster.
I'm
gonna interrupt this intro, Emma, to show you the greatest t-shirt in the world.
You have it. No way. I love it. Abby is wearing a shirt that just says Cynthia Plastercaster and it has a big dick.
That's it. It's got a penis.
It's great.
Okay. I have to sort of put on like my middle school health teacher cap right now to say there's going to be lots of talk about penises and breasts and sexual reproductive organs on this podcast. So, my grandparents and my dad might want to skip this one. We'd like to begin this podcast with some acknowledgments. This finale simply would not have been possible without the help of Cynthia's friends, Brian Wendorf, Babette Nov, and our special guest today, Jeff Economy. They gave us access to so many helpful resources and gave us insight to who Cynthia really was as an artist, lover of music, and most importantly, a friend. Let's take it away.
On May 24th in 1947, Cynthia Dorothy L. Britton was born in Chicago, Illinois. She was the child of a broken marriage. Cynthia's mom threw her alcoholic father out of the house when she was very young. Her mother was very strict. So strict that Cynthia and her friends nicknamed her the Warden. She didn't allow pop music in the house. Instead, she took her daughter to the movies and the theater. This sparked Cynthia's love for art and performers. She loved the flashy costumes and big personalities she saw on stage and screen. Her first crushes were Liberace and Jerry Orbach. That is such a phenomenal mix. She begged her mother to take her backstage to meet Jerry after they saw Carnival. After that, she was boy crazy, writing her crushes' names in her notebook and trying to sneak peeks of the boys in gym class. Being cool was an uphill battle for Cynthia. She had a penchant for finishing other kids' lunches at school. When her mom grounded her for a month, she got depressed and gained 40 pounds. For a lot of her life, Cynthia was terribly insecure about her weight and looks. She did manage to grow out her hair to the real groovy Jane Asher length. She wanted the androgynous pageboy haircut, but when she went to the hairdresser, she cut it all off and gave Cynthia a bubble hairdo. Imagine being a teenage girl in 1965 and wanting Brian Jones' hair, but getting Tracy Turnblad from Hairspray instead. That must have been so hard.
Oof.
Hair is such an emotional thing.
Yes, especially for teenage girls.
I would have cried.
Mm-hmm.
Don't worry, she did eventually get her page boy. The photo is on our Instagram page. But because her mother was so strict, Cynthia couldn't relate to a lot of her peers. That changed when rock and roll came knocking. After all, rock and roll is one great big theater show, with wild characters, costumes, and stories. The Beatles and the Rolling Stones started everything, and she wanted to be their groupie. Cynthia said to Vanity Fair, in quotes, "I'd say the British invasion made me what I am. When it happened, a lot of us were virgins. I would climb fire escapes like 15, 20 stories to get through the rock and roll floor because the hotel security guards just didn't allow girls in. They didn't think it was proper." As the Chicago Sharvar chapter of the Barclay Bankers, a name loaded with Cockney rhyming slang for sex, Cynthia and her friends met the Stones, Jeff Beck, Rod Stewart, Ronnie Wood, and the Zombies. Though Cynthia got backstage, not much would happen. She was shy and socially awkward. Though she was a Barclay banker, she had no idea what a handjob was, let alone how to give one. In quotes, "I didn't know what my goal was. I didn't even know why I was drawn there. The guys were like magnets." The older Cynthia got, the more hostile her relationship with her mother became. The warden was very conservative. She didn't like the idea of her daughter kissing boys, let alone sleeping with rock stars. One day, Cynthia caught her mother red-handed. She'd been reading her diaries the entire time. Upon reading this diary and finding out Cynthia was no longer a virgin, the warden threw her out. But she'd keep control of her daughter long after she left home. When Cynthia graduated high school, she wanted to become a cartoonist. Or maybe a great artist, like her inspiration Andy Warhol. But the warden didn't want that. She didn't see art as a proper career for a woman. Nevertheless, Cynthia was accepted to the art and architecture program at University of Illinois Chicago. She loved the freedom. In quotes, "Compared to my regimented high school, college was like another planet. You were at liberty to do whatever you felt like with your free time, wear whatever you wanted, as long as you could prove you were learning what was required." She'd show up to classes a half hour late. You can't rush applying false eyelashes.
So true.
Really, truly. And loved finally being able to wear pants. She'd submit drawings of the Beatles and Rolling Stones for her art school assignments. I love that detail. Her love portraits, as she called them, in quotes. "I would draw my favorite rock stars to vent my love and learn the art of realistic drawing. I couldn't control myself. I had to do them."
I have this really big print of her Beatles sketches, but I actually have copies of some of her other sketches in another room that I'm going to grab them right now. So sorry.
Oh, I cannot wait. No,
one second.
Good.
I'll play like funny intermission music on this or something in the edit.
I love that. Oh, she's coming back.
I kept all of these materials together in the box that they came in. Some of these are from her diaries, but this was one of her school assignments.
It is so good. Yeah, I can tell. I mean, it's so spot on.
There's a Jeff Beck somewhere in here. We're in the corner there. There's Mark Lindsay of Paul Revere and the Raiders. It looks like Jim Morrison lying on the ground, but I don't know if that's him.
It might be. The hair is kind of looking like it.
Really great stuff.
Yeah, she definitely had a great talent for all things art. One fateful afternoon, on the way out of class to meet her best friend Pest to see Paul Revere and Raiders, Cynthia's teacher gave the class a homework assignment. Make a cast of something hard. Cynthia had an idea. She was a self-described, in quotes, horny teenage virgin. But whenever she went backstage, she was always too shy to seduce the guy. She needed a fun and funny idea that would break the ice between her and her heroes, in quotes. It was like an equalizer, bringing them down to my level and me closer up to theirs. What if I cast a penis, she thought. Cynthia popped the question to Paul Lindsay that night. He didn't agree to be cast, but she did lose her virginity to him. So much in love with you. After that, she knew she was onto something. In January of 1968, Cynthia made her first cast. Her friend from college, Joel Copland, volunteered to be her guinea pig. The mold was made of alginates, which Cynthia got from her dentist. In quotes, when the batch started to look like pink malt meal, we shoved him in. But for some reason, he panicked and shoved his hand in two.
Crap, I gotta make sure it's still there.
They tried again with another friend, male groupie Al Hernandez. Cynthia also attempted to cast Peter Tork of the Monkees, but she cut her finger opening the alginate can and freaked out.
How on earth did Cynthia make it into Paul Revere and the Raiders and the Monkees hotel rooms? By making herself and her new assistant, Diane, look as professional as possible. Cynthia assembled a kit in a black case, not unlike a traveling doctor would carry, complete with a logo. Cynthia Albritton no more. For the rest of her life, she'd be known as Cynthia Plastercaster.
Such a good name.
Her kit consisted of plaster, alginates to make the mold, measuring scoops, baggies, Vaseline, a spatula, a vase to cast in.
I'm sorry.
No, it's a literal vase. I've seen photos.
I love it so much. I love how she wanted to be so professional but decided to go with the vase. This is such a classic right choice. Yeah, I get it.
Cups and a coffee can to mix in, and a thermometer to check the temperature of the water. If it was too hot or cold, the mold would fail. After a while, they included newspaper too. Plaster is messy, and hotels don't appreciate cleaning it up. The Plastercasters even had business cards. It was a way to get laughs, and laughs were the way to get guys to say yes. Cynthia's uniform was her dad's old mailman shirt. Having a uniform made the casters look more professional. Later on, Cynthia started wearing a lacy bra underneath her shirt. She wanted to feel cute while working.
Aww.
Early on, Keith Moon's whole pant leg made its way into the mix. He noticed Cynthia didn't have an apron, so he just ripped his pants right off. Like tearaway pants, you know, just whoop. Unfortunately, she didn't get to cast The Who. Roger Daltrey chickened out and left the room while the tour manager was being cast. Cynthia also found she needed a plater or assistant. Casting is not a one-woman job, and she needed someone to plate. More slang for stimulation. Having an assistant really helped with recruiting subjects. Cynthia would get nervous asking people to pose. If at all possible, she'd have a friend ask the guys instead. Some guys were shy and hesitant, others would come right up to her and kiss her on the mouth. How did she decide who to cast? She said to the Chicago Tribune, quote, "The criteria is talent and how much they make my day better."
Mm.
She had an uncanny ability to sense exactly who embodied the essence of rock and roll. Cynthia meticulously documented all of her casts in her rig books. Rigs are what she called penises. It sounded more professional than writing about dicks and cocks. In each entry of her rig book, Cynthia recorded the ratio of alginate to water, how much of the mixture her subject needed, who plated and what they did to stimulate her guest, and how the casting session went. She wrote out the whole procedure in the beginning of the book. First, Diane or whoever her assistant was would begin plating. While she was at that, Cynthia would shake the can of alginate powder well, open it, and grease the vase with Vaseline. It took equal scoops of powdered alginates to water to fill the can, and each scoop absolutely had to be level. Once the alginates and water were mixed, it was a race against time to pour the alginates into the vase, get the mold set just enough, and the rig in. Considering all went well, it would take about a minute to set, Cynthia was always very open about this artistic process. She actually wanted to sell kits, little casting kits.
That's such a good idea.
So you too can be a plaster caster.
I don't know how many people would have actually picked that up, but it would be a fun idea.
Oh, could you imagine like a bachelorette party gift?
That would be fantastic. That would be
fantastic.
It really would.
She called her creations her babies or her sweet babies and thought of them cozy and cuddly. She also considered them art and wanted them to be displayed as such. If someone curved to the left, they'd be displayed with someone who curved to the right. All this begs the question, why plaster? In an interview in the 2000s, Cynthia said plaster had a, quote, feminine, virginal quality to it, as opposed to bronze. The pure white of plaster reminded her of ancient Greek marble sculptures.
On February 25th, in 1968, 20-year-old Cynthia Plastercaster landed the opportunity of a lifetime, casting Jimi Hendrix. The experience burst onto the scene at just the right time. Cynthia had just moved out of the warden's house. She would never have allowed her daughter to play a black man's music at home, let alone rock and roll. She squeezed into a red and white Swiss dot mini dress, borrowed her roommate's feather boa, and piled into Diane's car with their second assistant, Marilyn. After the show, they followed Jimmy's limo all the way to the Conrad Hilton. It was Chicago's equivalent to the infamous Riot House, and the same hotel where Cynthia lost her virginity to Paul. She was familiar with the layout of the hotel, so she and the girls camped right out and waited. Soon, Jimmy arrived wearing a beautiful orange velvet suit and totally stared at Cynthia's boobs. The girls boldly introduced themselves as the Plastercasters of Chicago. "We've already called your secretary to make an appointment with you. I heard about you from somewhere in the cosmos," he said. In typical Jimmy fashion, he was the first rock star to agree to this crazy plaster process. He wanted to see what it was all about. He brought the girls up to his room and they got to work. We were lucky enough to receive scans from Cynthia's rig book, special for this episode. Here's what her Jimmy entry says.
Number 0004, Jimi Hendrix. February 25th, 1968, Conrad Hilton Hotel, room 1628. Diane, plater. Cynthia, mold and plaster mixer. Marilyn, Cynthia's assistant. We needed a ratio of 28 to 28, alginates to water, and found this just barely sufficient. Hendrix has got just about the biggest rig I've ever seen! We needed to plunge him through the entire depth of the vase. In view of all these dodgy presidents, we got a beautiful mold. He even kept his hard for the entire minute. He got stuck, however, for about 15 minutes. His hair did. But he was an excellent sport. Didn't panic. Even Nolan Mitch didn't politely refrain from going up next, as one would expect. He actually enjoyed it. Bulbed the impression after it had set. In fact, I believe the reason we couldn't get his rig out was that it wouldn't get soft.
This is such a giggly episode.
The mold was, in quotes, beautiful, even if poor Jimmy's hair got stuck in it. But the initial cast was a flop. Cynthia messed up the mixture and took the cast out too early. Jimmy thought the whole thing was very funny. He was impressed by how professional the whole thing was. After the Jimmy incident, Cynthia added loop to her process, so no more guys would get stuck. Each subject could choose whatever scent or flavor they wanted. While Cynthia was pouring his mold, Jimmy moved in to kiss her. But she turned him down. She had a big crush on Noel Redding ever since she saw his photo in the NME. For years, she kept a photo of Noel glued to the inside of her rig book. She didn't want to outright tell Jimmy she wanted Noel instead, but Cynthia wasn't the type to sleep with more than just her fave rave. That's old school groupie slang for your favorite member of the band. In the typical Jimmy way, he understood, and Cynthia actually got to sleep with Noel that night. So the plaster caster thing, after all, was the breaker that she was looking for.
It was. It really was.
I love that. The experience returned to Chicago about a month after Jimmy's cast. When Cynthia saw their limo again, she excitedly waved her suitcase around. The guys saw, they recognized her business card,
and invited her right on into cast Noel Redding. In quotes, number 0005, Noel Redding, March 30th, 1968, Conrad Hilton Hotel, room 1136. Diane Plater, Cynthia Mold and Plaster Mixer. I would like to note that Marilyn was present to resume her duties as general assistant. However, at the time, being very stoned, she was unable to offer any service, save a couple random scratching on the newspaper with a marking pen. The mold mixed well and Diane provided filito, as Noel called it.
He definitely meant fellatio. One of my favorite things about Noel were his little anachronisms.
That's so sweet. I had no idea how to pronounce that because I'm sure it's not a word.
No, you got it. You got it.
But just as the girls were about to plunge him into the mold, someone knocked on the door. It was their manager and the guys were supposed to be headed to the show. Whatever erection he had was gone, in quotes. Thus, instead of diving in mightily straight in, we had to shove and pound it in. And it twisted like a worm. This is just what the cast looks like, a worm peeking out of the ground.
Another one of the funniest stories in the Cynthia canon is the tale of numbers 10 and 11. These casts were born from a weird, chaotic night with the MC5, from kidnapping Danny Fields to drinking Timothy Leary's jug of acid wine and somehow winding up at his mother-in-law's house. Most nights with the MC5 were weird and chaotic. The guys got it in their perpetually stoned heads that they wanted to be cast in the same container at the same time. Cynthia talked them out of this. There was no way she could cast two at once. The vase just wouldn't allow for that. They relented, but still insisted upon being cast at the same time. Cynthia either showed up without a player that night, or the girl she brought was totally starstruck and couldn't stop talking. So the guys had to stimulate themselves. Dennis had no problem. Wayne did. He couldn't get himself going in time, so the mixture hardened without him. Once he did get part of the way in, it was cold. In the words of the man himself, quote, "It wasn't very erotic." So, as so eloquently put by Martha Bain for the Chicago Reader, quote, "In the annals of rock history, Wayne Kramer will forever have a 2-inch dick." Even that estimate is generous. I have paperwork from some exhibition Cynthia did proving only 1 3/4 of an inch were captured. There are photos of the incident. They're hilarious.
I mean, the issue with this episode is that a lot of the things cannot be published, so we'll have to see.
Thankfully, Wayne had a sense of humor about the whole thing.
Oh, yeah.
Quote, "This is how I'm gonna be remembered. For the rest of my days, great rock star stud that I am," he proudly declared in the Plaster Cast Your documentary, holding up the end of a banana. Around the same time as the Dennis and Wayne cast, Cynthia and Diane were featured in Rolling Stone magazine. Baron Woolman did the special photography series on groupies. The issue is highly sought after today. I'm still looking for a copy. You can find most of Baron's photos online and in his coffee table book. Of the Plastercasters, the Sanchez twins, and Cynthia's new friends, the GTOs. Sometime in 1968, the Plastercasters of Chicago were in hot pursuit of Cream. They made it all the way up to Eric Clapton's hotel room, where he introduced them to his buddy, Frank Zappa. Cynthia was repulsed by him at first. Quote, "He looked like a drug addict. He looked scary," she thought. But he wasn't scary, and he certainly wasn't a drug addict. He didn't want to be cast, and neither did Eric. But Frank was fascinated by groupies and adored what the Plastercasters were doing. Frank recorded Cynthia's first phone call with the GTOs and put it on their only album, Permanent Damage. Miss Christine, the Zappa family's nanny at the time, didn't really get what the plaster casters were doing, but Miss Pamela absolutely did. Let's play some of their giggly conversation for you all.
He's coming here, you know, in 3 weeks, and I'm dying. I am just dying.
Oh, you're dying.
Well, a week ago. Oh, did you see him this time? Oh, what happened? Did you see him? Oh, wow. How was it?
Miss P went to visit Cynthia in Chicago for a week that year. They saw Fleetwood Mac together on New Year's Eve and became close friends. They had a brief falling out over Jimmy Page and Noel Redding. Cynthia liked them first, but Pamela slept with them both. Girl code stuff. But when one of Pamela's roommates stole her diaries in the 70s, Cynthia gave her all the letters they wrote to each other. If it weren't for Cynthia saving all of that, Miss P wouldn't have been able to write I'm with the band. There's a scene of VH1's Let's Spend the Night Together with them both in it, surrounded by Cynthia's collection of phallus-shaped things in her apartment. It's delightful.
These two seem like a match made in heaven.
It's us in 25 years, honestly. Oh. You're visiting my apartment just full of odd shit.
Oh, I love that. That's so wonderful. I cannot wait. Feminists of the 60s and 70s looked down on groupies as a whole, but especially the plaster casters. They didn't like that Cynthia and her assistants were serving men. Groupies are still a hot topic. Mm-hmm. We've spoken about it a few times on this show. Mm-hmm. I have made a YouTube video about baby groupies once. It's been up at like 500,000 views or something, and the comments are wild. Mm-hmm. If you start talking about groupies publicly, you will get yourself in hot water. In the decades since the plaster casters, views are slowly changing on Cynthia's art. It's still taboo to much of the general public, but as we heard earlier in this episode, her casting process wasn't so much erotic as it was clinical. Cold alginates didn't diminish any of the fun though. Her casts were ownerships of her sexual freedom. Making plaster replicas of penises is a visual representation of the sexual revolution of the 60s. Cynthia's art celebrated manhood and feminism alike. Soon the plaster casters became something of a rock and roll myth. Fake plaster casters popped up in Boston and as far away as Tokyo. Even Grace Slick questions whether the plaster casters were real in her book Somebody to Love. It's kind of a rock and roll myth at this point. The proof is in the pasty white plaster pudding and in Cynthia's journals and rig book. In 1977, Kiss released their Love Gun album. On that record is Plaster Caster, their song about Cynthia. But she never cast any of Kiss. She didn't care much for them at all, or any of the glam rockers really. She thought they were more about visuals than music. She preferred garage bands and local musicians. It really rubbed her the wrong way that Gene Simmons made people believe he'd been cast when he hadn't. The two did a radio show together and settled their differences, but it seems he only agreed to it in hopes Cynthia would ask to cast him. I love how this became a thing that everyone wanted to do. It became kind of like this gold status. She never did cast him. Surprisingly, Gene wasn't the only guy who lied about having an encounter with the plaster casters. Ginger Baker of Cream, Steve Miller, Keith Emerson, and Rod Stewart all told tales about supposedly being cast. On the other hand, there were a few guys like Brian Ferry of Roxy Music and David Bowie that Cynthia blew her chances with because she missed their cues. She was really interested in Alice Cooper and very nearly asked him about posing for her. He even handed her a hairbrush to brush his luscious black locks with, but she totally clammed up and missed her chance. When the Cramps played Tuts on Belmont, Lux Interior expressed interest. The problem was the Cramps set wouldn't be over until 2 that morning. Cynthia had work at 9.
Such a bummer.
But I love that she was living this double life.
Yeah.
It wasn't all fun and games. Cynthia was rejected many times.
There were a number of failed castings as well. Sometimes the ratio of alginate to water wouldn't be right, other times the group would be interrupted. Eric Burdon of The Animals and Pete Shelley of Buzzcock are the most famous mold failures. One by the airplane captain saying it was time to take off and kicking the plaster casters out of his plane, and the other by faulty mixture. Other times it was a skill issue. It took a record 4 attempts to cast Chris Connolly of Revolting Cocks. He had, quote, a cursed dick. Though she grew to be a rock and roll legend, she never became wealthy from any of her artwork. She was a starving artist through and through, working various odd jobs to get by. Sometimes she was a typesetter, others a key punch operator. Jello Biafra of the Dead Kennedys described her as, quote, a real person, as opposed to the stereotype groupie, with a real job to support herself, while she worked on her art when she could.
Sometimes she couldn't work on her art, whether it be a sweatshop job or a historic court case. She moved out to LA for a year and a half to chase this dream. Bizarre Records gave her an allowance so she could buy art supplies, but for one reason or another, plans were put on hold. Cynthia hated LA. She was by herself now. Diane got married and settled down. All her friends were still back in Chicago, and it seems that because she was famous now too, the guys stopped saying yes to being cast.
Yeah, I don't get it.
That's lame. In 1971, Cynthia's apartment was broken into. Some of her belongings were stolen. She realized her work needed protection. Thankfully, Frank's manager and business partner, Herbie Cohen, was there to help. Or so she thought. Frank and Gail trusted him at the time, so Cynthia did too. She temporarily entrusted her collection to him in California with the idea that an exhibition would soon be put on. But they were all wrong. Herb couldn't be trusted. Frank took him to court for $10 million he allegedly pocketed.
Wow.
Then, after an 8-year break in Cynthia's art making and a decade of trying to get her cast back, Herb refused. In 1991, Cynthia filed a lawsuit. She went out to California again, and the case went before court in 1993. Her lawyers agreed to take her on pro bono. One of them, Santiago Durango, was guitarist of legendary noise band Big Black. I lost my marbles when I found that out.
That is such a crazy coincidence.
Yeah.
Connection.
Back in Chicago, the Hard Aid benefit was put on to raise additional legal funds.
Mm-hmm. She's all up there with all the quirky little...
She loved a good dick joke. Here, Cynthia made her spoken word debut, doing dramatic readings of her stories from her rig books. Plastercaster V. Cohen became something of a media circus, with curious late-night TV hosts gawking at the idea of a lawsuit over plaster penises. Cynthia had to wear a scarf and sunglasses to court so the warden wouldn't recognize her in the newspapers. Somehow, she still didn't know what her daughter did. When all was said and done, Cynthia spent an uncomfortable 2 days on the stand, quote, talking about dicks. The judge ruled in her favor. She won a $12,000 settlement and got all but 3 of her casts back, numbers 17, 19, and 24. As a thank you, Cynthia offered to cast her lawyer. He politely declined.
Oh, I love that. I bet she made this. This is like such a pure idea, but it's also so insanely awkward.
Yeah.
But I feel like at this point, she must have cast so many penises that she was just like, oh, this is a nice thing. But I bet that lawyer, he was like, what's going on?
He was like, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. In her book proposal, Cynthia said the court case was, quote, a turning point for me in a positive way. I was sick of getting pushed around by slick music biz types and sweatshop owners. I felt ready to shove a whole new, improved, assertive me down the world's throat. Occasionally, I found myself on the stimulating end of the cocks I casted. No more mousy mold mixer. Cynthia was finally confident in her sexuality, something she'd been helping others with for nearly 30 years. But now she had a new insecurity. Her age. Since the age of 25, she'd worried about being past her prime. When you consider how harsh rock and roll is to women and just how disposable women are in this world, one understands how Cynthia would get to feeling this way. But that doesn't really matter because her personality was always so youthful.
It does.
She was, in a lot of ways, kind of a perpetual teenager.
Yeah, she had this optimism
and her fun. Yeah.
Also, you and I are both turning 26 next year, so I don't want to believe that that's old. Because we would be the next old ladies then.
I mean, Miss Pamela talked about it too in her book. 25 was like geriatric as far as groupieing went in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean,
a different world.
Yeah, it truly was. As far as getting married and having kids went. But also, as mentioned earlier, a lot of these groupies were so young. They were 13, 14. So by the time you're 25, you're almost double their age. It's insane.
That's the difference between groupies of the 60s and groupies of the 70s. The groupies of the 60s were either, you know, getting out of high school. They were in college like Cynthia was.
Yeah.
But the 70s, they were kids, man. I don't know what happened to cause that shift, but whatever it is, I don't like it.
No.
The 1990s and 2000s enjoyed a 1960s revival. Shoegazers sported Beatle haircuts and played Rickenbackers, while girls wore mini dresses, Mary Janes, and Twiggy-like haircuts. The Jimi Hendrix Experience, the Yardbirds, the Doors, Led Zeppelin, Frank Zappa, and Jefferson Airplane were all inducted to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and with the rise of CDs and digital media, it was easier than ever for young people to enjoy the music of the greats. This ignited new interest in the icons of the decade. This greater 60s revival, plus the court case, put Cynthia Plastercaster back in the limelight. She started doing her dramatic readings, and her work picked up again. She cast Jello Biafra of the Dead Kennedys, Richard Lloyd of television, Mark Atkins, the artist Momus. He claimed he had, quote, the second biggest dick in Britain. It didn't exactly pan out that way. She was interviewed for Vanity Fair and other publications. Despite loving the renewed attention her art got, Cynthia was insecure about being a groupie in her 50s. But if the next chapter of her story is any indication, you're never too old to pursue what you love.
What is it? Nardwuar?
Nardwuar.
Nardwuar. Okay.
I love Nardwuar.
Nardwuar. In 1997, Cynthia got the Nardwuar treatment. It's just as delightful as you'd think. Nardwuar has this zany, goofy energy, and Cynthia was a bit bewildered by it all. In an interview, he asked her about a rumor that she turned down the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. She said, quote, "The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? I'm not sure, but it might kind of suck. I think I might have to go to Cleveland myself and find it out. But it just seems to have the biggest exhibitions of the wrong people, from what I've heard. I've heard that Nirvana's, which I really adore, exhibition is bigger than the Velvet Underground, and Frank Zappa took too long to get inducted. They did call me and asked me if I would be interested." In 2000, Cynthia began casting women. We were very fortunate to receive copies of her breast cast books for this episode as well. Compared to her penis casts, this period of her career is woefully undocumented. We think it's a great fit for what our show is all about. Though it didn't make the final cut, the Plastercaster film crew captured Cynthia's first ever breast cast. Sort of. Numbers 001 and 002 came from Susie Gardner, guitarist and singer of L7. It was a chaotic process. There was a last-minute venue change, Cynthia used a new brand of alginate, people were literally throwing paper towels at Susie so she wouldn't ruin her dress. There were twice as many assistants involved, and a whole camera crew in this bathroom.
Even fitting a whole camera crew in Cynthia's apartment was a doozy. I have the DVD of the Plastercaster documentary, so I do have this scene. Props to them for working out the logistics.
They really wanted to make this work. It was a learning experience for everyone involved, but Susie's cast came out great. In her breast book, Cynthia said, quote, "The next morning I plaster casted and gave birth to two beautiful bouncing baby boobs. The areola detail is real pretty. I goofed up at first and inserted the clip upside down in one of the casts, but then my pal Darren came over and bent it back so it could hang right side up. How dainty they look between my 3D poodle portrait and fake mink momus pillow, waiting patiently for more and more baby sisters to arrive and keep them company." Her collection of breasts cast included Laetitia Sadier of Stereo Lab, Sally Timms, and Karen O of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. It proved to be a much smaller collection. Casting breasts meant a much bigger container and many more helpers. And there was a lot of trial and error.
It's unfortunate, really, that I don't think she ever quite worked out a foolproof method for breast casts like she did with the rigs. Because it's a lot more surface area involved, you know, and you need more people to help hold everything up.
You need a hell of a big vase for that.
At first, she used these two, like, Pyrex bowls.
That might
but
work.
But that gave a lot, but there were a lot of air bubbles, so then they tried, why not, like, a big Tupperware? What if she bends over? Okay, that doesn't work. How about we hold them up?
In 2000, Cynthia cast her first full band, Christine Margaret and Danny Doll Rod of the Demolition Doll Rod. The documentary follows the casting of Danny as well as Bill Dolan of Five Style. They were numbers 0067 and 0065, respectively. David Yo of the Jesus Lizard got the coveted number 69, if you must know. I must have known.
Yes. I figured at the very least you would appreciate the funny number
I really
information.
Do.
I believe the Demolition Doll Rods were the only full group she cast. She almost got there with the Experience, but I think they broke up before they could get back to Chicago so she could cast Mitch Mitchell. Unfortunate.
Only one was missing.
Mm-hmm.
She would have got the whole trio.
Mm-hmm. So Brian gave me the contact information of pretty much everybody that could help us with this episode for Cynthia. A few replied, they were all very gracious and helpful. Brian also put me in contact with Jeff Economy. He was the director of photography for the Plastercaster documentary and good friends with Cynthia both before and after production. We are very fortunate to have him on board for this episode as our special guest. While Emma was on vacation last week, Jeff agreed to hop on a call with me to talk about the making of Plastercaster and his friendship with Cynthia. Let's hear all about Cynthia as an artist, an all-around beautiful person, from someone who knew her best. Hello, Jeff. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Nice to be here.
We're having you on for our season finale of the Dolls podcast. Again, you just get me today. Emma's on vacation. So this is a new experience for the both of us. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to all of the listeners today?
Oh, sure. I'm Jeff Economy. I'm here. Well, I've done a lot of things, but I believe I'm here because I was part of the documentary about Cynthia Plastercaster. I was one of two cinematographers and one of the producers, and I was also very good friends with Cynthia. She and I were pretty close. That's a friendship that predated the documentary. We go back a little bit, or went back, I should say.
How did you meet Ms. Plastercaster?
Well, so you know Brian Wendorf. Mm-hmm. Brian is the co-founder of the Chicago Underground Film Festival. It all came out of a very informal thing that he and his friend Jay Bliznick were doing. Mm. I mean, Jay says he's the founder. You can let the two of them hash that out. But for years, the films were chosen through a selection committee where it was very informal. It was just held at a different person's apartment every week, and a bunch of people would sit around the living room and look at movies.
Oh, really?
And a woman I was dating at the time was part of that group already. Mm. And when we started seeing each other, she invited me to the screenings. And that's where I met Cynthia. She was one of those. She was one of the people as well.
Mm.
And so Cynthia and I got to be pretty friendly doing that.
She did love film.
Oh, she did. She was crazy about it.
What was she like?
Gosh, that is a very big question. I guess I've thought about this a bit, especially since she's passed. Mm-hmm. There's not a simple answer to that. I mean, I got an enormous amount of insight into who she was and how she operated and how she thought and all that. When we were making the film, it was sort of on my mind all the time on all of our minds. Myself and Jessica, who is the director, and Brian, who's the editor, and Ken, the other cinematographer. We just kind of started living in her head for a couple of years, and she was very complicated in certain ways, and a really interesting mix of, I don't know what I would say, impulses, interests. I described her to some people at the time as the world's oldest teenager. She had these enthusiasms that hadn't really changed since she was 15 or whatever, but she also had the life experience and the insight of a person who had lived the years that she lived. So it was remarkable how she would sometimes, you would think you were dealing with this goofy, kind of ditzy girl who was, really into rock bands and the boys' hair and all this stuff. And then she would come out and say something, and you were like, holy shit, that was really kind of devastatingly profound and in a very offhand way.
Watching that film, I'm so struck by, I guess you would call it the balance between artist and fan. Not even just artist and groupie, but as an artist and as a fan of other people's art. That's, I guess, what always moved me about Cynthia. I guess that leads me into my next question. What inspired you and Jessica and Brian and you all to make this film?
Well, it didn't originate with me exactly. A number of people had approached Cynthia over the years about making a film, and for various reasons, it didn't happen. And we'd had conversations about it, and it was just the wrong personality, the wrong timing, the wrong approach, whatever. And at one point, she said, "Oh, I think I'm gonna make a film with this woman. You should meet her." I was kind of surprised because I didn't even know that there were negotiations going on at that time. And so I met Cynthia and Jessica one night at the Rainbow in Chicago, and Jessica and I hit it off. We ended up dating for a couple of years. She had really just started. I think she had done a grand total of one shoot
Really?
on the project. And since I was also a filmmaker, it just sort of kind of naturally evolved into, well, you should be a part of this too. And so I ended up shooting probably a little over half of the film, and Ken shot maybe a little less than half, but I don't know the exact proportions. So it just I was just happy to be one of the people entrusted with telling that story, because I felt a certain amount of protectiveness, I guess, and a sense of like, if this story really is going to be told, it should be told right. And
Yes.
I wanted to do that justice.
Why did you all feel it was an important story to tell?
Well, again, I can't speak for anyone else. I can only speak for myself, really. But I mean, she had always been kind of a mythological, idea to me. I mean, I first heard of the idea of plaster casting when I was probably 7 or 8 years old, when I heard that Jim Croce song, 5 Short Minutes.
That's right.
And I didn't understand the reference at all. It was one of those things that was completely baffling. Like, what was he singing about in that song? And as a kid, prepubescent boy, I was just like, I don't get it.
So was that how you first heard of the Plaster Casters of Chicago?
In retrospect, it was. I realized that was where the seed first got planted in my head, that this was an idea that existed. And then over the years, as I got more interested in rock music and rock history, I think the idea just started presenting itself. And I had sort of an idea that this was something that people did, and it was this goofy 60s, eccentric, sexy art thing. I didn't really know how serious it was. It was like, is this real? Is this did this really happen? Is it like people smoking bananas? Did that really happen? So when I finally met her, it was like, oh, this is a real thing, and this is a real person, and here's her collection and all that.
So when you first walked into her apartment and you were met with all of those casts and her collection of oddities, what was going on inside your head?
It was kind of hilarious. Such a phallic overload to be in an apartment where everything is longer than it is wide. I was just like, how did you amass all of this stuff?
Like some kind of a Willy Wonka thing. You're describing it as longer than it is wide.
Well, that's true, and it's and she was very proud of it. I mean, she loved to show things off, but she was also very matter of fact. So it wasn't, I don't remember the first time I went in and as like this formative moment. I don't have like a specific memory of that. I just remember being there and just being kind of overwhelmed. by everything, by everything in the place. I'm sure you've seen in the movie and in TV shows where people are showing her
I
collection and
have.
they're just kind of walking around like, oh my God. I'm sure it was very much like that.
I imagine making a film like Plastercaster would present some unique challenges. So, what were the challenges you faced making this thing?
Yeah, Cynthia had she had given Jessica and the production team pretty much carte blanche to shoot whatever.
Okay.
So, she sold her life story rights to the
Oh.
production, and so we had permission to shoot pretty much everything.
That's a lot of trust she put in you guys.
It was actually now, when I think about it, I mean, there's a certain thing with what happens with a documentary where it reaches that point where you either trust the person you're working with or you don't, and it's really hard to draw lines and say, well, you can talk about this and you can cover this, but you can't cover this. And even if you do that, there's a certain kind of trust in the collaboration that just has to be there, where you're just trusting, all right, are they going to shoot this appropriately? Are they going to tell this story appropriately? Are they going to be respectful and serious about how the filmmakers are going about it? It's hard to explain this unless you've made a documentary, but it's almost inconceivable that anyone would want to do it unless they're deeply in love with their subjects. It takes so much time, so much mental, emotional, every kind of energy to invest yourself in that.
For years.
Yeah, and in our case, it was well over 2 years that we were shooting with her. And I think the fact that she and I were good friends before I got involved with the production, that went a long way as well. But she was pretty unfiltered. There's a scene where she's talking to her mother, the warden,
Yes.
kind of hitting her up for money for a loan. It's not the most flattering thing to have people film this in your life when you're in your 50s and you're still hitting up your parents or financial support. And you can tell that she's not super proud of it, but she's just like, well, this is my reality. This is where I'm at. And she let me shoot that, and it was, well, you know me. This is who I am. So it's doing justice to those moments.
So, what series of events was Plastercaster supposed to follow?
Well, it was always intended to really tell the story, so that people who didn't know anything about her, who only just maybe knew that she existed or that this phenomena existed, they could see that and they could get the basic idea of what it was and how it worked. So that was always part of the intention, to see her go from the approach, one of her subjects, from when she first approached them to all the way to having the cast made. I think that was done pretty successfully in terms of, it kind of demystified the whole process of how it worked.
It did.
Because she wasn't particularly secretive about it. She gave all sorts of talks. She told everybody how it worked. She joked about it. She had a fantastic sense of humor, and she just thought it was the goofiest thing on top of everything else. So she would talk about how it worked at the drop of a hat.
She sort of saw the humor in what she did, but she also took her art very seriously. Like you said, she was very matter of fact about what she did.
It was almost weirdly matter of fact. I first met her, I guess, 1990. This would have been 1997, and I saw over the years that her ability to even describe what she was doing as art was something that she got more confident about as the years went on. I mean, she talks about that in the film. It was Frank Zappa who first planted that idea in her head. She was on Zappa's payroll for a couple of years.
When he was trying to put on an exhibition, right?
He had heard that there was this groupie phenomenon, and these girls were doing these casts, and he thought, how fantastic. He was just basically supporting them for a couple of years so they could do what they do. And he thought, maybe there'll be a book out of it, maybe there'll be an exhibition, there'll be some material manifestation of that down the road.
What sequences stick out for you as the moments that shaped Plastercaster? Not to make a pun, but just sort of shape what this thing was going to be.
Well, the Wayne Kramer was the sequence was a big favorite for me.
That's my favorite.
I think it works so well as a self-contained piece. Like you could just see the beginning, that sequence from beginning to end, and it would tell you so much about who she is and how she worked and her relationship with some of her subjects. And it's just a really funny scene.
Who handed Wayne the banana?
Well, that was his initiative. We shot it backstage at a show he did at the Double Door, a club in Chicago. I already knew Wayne from having been part of the MC5 documentary. So he and I had a relationship. We hadn't seen each other in a couple of years at that point because I had left that project, and that's a whole other story. But so we had kind of a reunion. Oh, hey, good to see you, et cetera, et cetera. I was doing the sound, so I was holding the boom. So you see at times where Wayne's telling the story and he's looking off screen. He's looking right at me. He's like telling me the story. And I felt a little weird because it was a little bit of an ambush. Cynthia was convinced that she had caught a case of the clap from somebody in the band.
That's right.
And so she was determined to call them out on it. And I was a little sheepish, like, I don't know how I feel about this, like sandbagging Wayne Kramer, but it was like, well, you know, if it's true, it's true. Let's just do it. And of course it turned out not to be true. And she's checking her notes and, oh, you're right. It, you know, as Wayne was telling the story, we were in his dressing room backstage and he was thinking, oh, it's like, and he just ran across the room and got a banana out of the fruit bowl. So that was an unplanned moment.
I imagine there were a lot of unplanned moments with Cynthia.
Yes. Well, that whole storyline with the not being able to get her casts back from the plaster foundry, that was, you know, completely unplanned. She had met this guy who had this plaster replication business, and she was hiring him to make replicas for her show. And then she couldn't get a hold of him and he wasn't there. And she was seriously distraught. It was one of the only times when you see her on camera, she's like, I can't talk about this. Turn the camera off. That was genuine. She was just like, I'm too upset. I can't talk about this right now. Oh, here's this crazy reprise of this story with Herb Cohen where she couldn't get the cast back. And here it is happening again.
As a viewer, that is instantly what I thought of. Again, with trust. Seems to be a big part of this project.
Well, and she was very trusting. And because she had, you know, at times limited means, she was in a position of having to put herself in a position of trust, you know. But it's also who she was. You know, she didn't have a lot of money. She was always hurting for money. She never cooked a meal in her life, so she was always eating out.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
I mean, now that I think of it, she used her stove for her art. You can't really mix food and plaster like that.
The only thing I ever saw her eat in her apartment was cereal.
Oh.
You know, there's a burrito place, you know, block away from where she lived, and she ate there all the time. We even shot a little sequence in there, but it ended up not getting used. You know, everyone has their survival skills, and part of her survival skills were being able to identify who was going to take care of her and who was going to have her interests at heart. And she had a really solid core of those people, and she had enough of them that she wouldn't burn anybody out. Like her friend John Connors, he had these salons at his apartment every week where people would get together and watch films. Yeah. She went every time. And, you know, that was her Sunday dinner. She would go to John's and she would eat his pizza. And he knew that that was part of the deal. And he was like, it's Cynthia. And he wouldn't necessarily put up with that with everyone else in his life. Mm-hmm. But because it was Cynthia, it was like, what's the big deal? I can afford a pizza.
What about her endeared her to others and to you?
She was just so genuine. You know, there wasn't any artifice about her. There wasn't any kind of pose or facade or shell where you felt like you had to get past this defense mechanism to get to the real person. You know, she was completely approachable. I mean, I never saw an instance where someone was like, oh my God, oh, is that her? I want to meet her. And I would just like, just go talk to her, you know? And she approached everybody the same way. There was no like, oh, who are you? Why do I have to deal with this weirdo, you know?
Because she was a weirdo.
But, you know, a lot of weirdos are very wary, or they have their defenses up, or they have sort of hoops you have to jump through to get into their inner circle. Mm-hmm. She approached everyone just with a very open sensibility. Like when I first met her, I was, you know, I was a little intimidated, like, oh my God, this person who's legendary is here in this room. You know, but when you're just sitting around eating chips and telling dirty jokes, it was like it very quickly got very casual. She and I both went through a bad breakup around the same time. Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time just going out, and the two of us, you know, commiserating about our miserable love lives, and how disappointed we were, et cetera, et cetera. And so that was a pretty serious bonding experience. I mean, I don't know if you've ever been through a bad breakup, but you need someone to at least go, oh yeah, that was shitty. You know, and to pat you on the back and go, oh, you're okay. It'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And we were doing that for each other. I think we got to maybe a different level of intimacy because of that.
What did you learn from Cynthia following her around for those 2 years?
What did I learn? Well, it helped change my ideas of what art is and what art can be. Mm-hmm. And how that's defined. I mean, I would never say that when I first heard about it, I didn't think it was art. It taught me a lot about how artists just live their lives and how that process is part of their everyday life. It was part of her just being in the world. You know, to get a little more deep or personal with that, I mean, I learned, I think, a lot of just about what a real friendship is and what that's made out of and what the contours of that are. You know, she would lead with oh, doll, I have to go to Walgreens. Can you are you going to go? Oh, you're going to go to the drugstore. Oh, can you give me a ride? And then you're at the Walgreens, and oh, can we just make one more stop at the bank to, you know, and just kind of go, Cynthia, come, you know, then it'd be a little amusingly exasperating, and sometimes we just look at each other, and I would, you know, and then we would laugh because it's like, I know what you're doing. Yeah, I know, doll. It's okay. We can do it. You know, she would call me up to about a tech support thing on her computer, and we'd be on the phone for 3 hours, and I'm trying to talk her through doing some whatever, you know. And sometimes that would stick out more prominently in my mind. I go, oh, that's Cynthia again. Okay, there goes the rest of my evening. But the other side of that was that she was just as invested in the other side of that. You know, there are people who do that, and they're, you know, they're users or they're energy vampires, and you go, God, here they are calling again. With her, it was always a real conversation, and it was always, you know, like an in-depth, lengthy one. You know, when I left Chicago, for instance, I went through kind of a rough patch. Cynthia, I think, more than almost anyone else in my life, made a regular, concerted effort to just call and say, "Hey, how you doing? What's going on with you?" And sometimes I would be like, "Oh, it's things are kind of crappy, and I'm miserable, and this is why, and I don't have any great gossip to share." And she'd be like, "It's okay." And something I think I'm still kind of contending with since she's passed is, you know, I don't know how much I was. I mean, I guess I was aware of this, but it was never at the forefront of my thoughts. But I mean, she was really fucking funny all the time. She was just like unfailingly. I mean, the last thing she ever said to me was a dirty joke. You know, this was like basically on her deathbed, you know. But she was also just incredibly kind. And it's something that people talk about a lot, and it's something that people try to be conscious of. But there's a difference between being kind and just being nice, you know, or being, you know, polite or indulgent. She was just very genuine that way. You know, if she cared, she cared.
Those kind of pretensions just didn't exist in Cynthia's world, it sounds
No, they
like.
didn't. And she really re relished, you know, puncturing that. Like the scene in the movie where she's at the office of the guy who's got the plaster foundry, and she's like, "Oh yeah, I took a class on fist fucking." And then she looks at the camera and she kind of giggles, like she knows she's saying something naughty, but it's funny to her too. You know? And then Brian's like, "Okay."
I guess that brings us to my last question, which I'm asking on behalf of Emma. She sent this one along to me. From knowing Cynthia, what insights did you gain about the role of women in rock and roll?
You know, probably if you're talking about insights, probably having a little bit more of a front seat in terms of seeing the kind of bullshit that women have to deal with all the time in that world. I mean, for as long back as I can think, I've considered myself a feminist. I've never had any problem with some of the things that, you know, like the thing that all those Beatles fanboys do where they talk about Yoko Ono and, you know, those guys, they start, it's like instant shorthand for me of like, oh, you're probably ignorant and a racist, and I don't need to take anything you're saying seriously. You know, and I learned those lessons early on. But I don't think I had to experience it as much. Seeing A, how sometimes people reacted to her, and also being on the receiving end of some of that same scorn by virtue of what film we were making gave me a little taste of, oh, this is probably a lot closer to what a lot of women in this world deal with all the time. And I think it helped me be more sensitive to what some of those struggles are than just the burden of having to deal with that every day in, day out, that I think most men don't have any consciousness of, or they don't understand it as being so comprehensive.
What do you hope people take away from Cynthia's story?
Well, first of all, I hope they come away more amused than anything, you know, because people, I think, go into what that story is with this idea of it being this very sexual thing and so lascivious and, There's something so naughty about it. And certainly that's partly true about it, but it's just such a playful thing. It's such a lighthearted thing. Like, I think some people imagine her when they haven't met Cynthia or had never got to meet her, they're just like, ah, kid, yeah, you had seen the things that I've seen, you know, chomping on a cigar and being really crusty. And she's not like that at all, or wasn't like that at all. And so I would hope that people come away from that with a feeling of like, oh, what a sweetheart. Ultimately, you know, on top of or below that or whatever, I mean, that's who she was as a person. She was just a real sweetheart.
I want to thank you so much for giving us all, me, Emma, listeners. But I just want to thank you for giving us that key insight into what Cynthia was like as a person and what it was like working on Plastercaster.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for asking me.
Thank you so much. All right, back to the show.
Thank you so much for asking my questions.
Of course, you've worked in the film industry before, so you knew what to ask by all
This was so
accounts.
interesting.
I was more asking from like the art perspective and from the Cynthia perspective, but you knew what to talk about with the film, so thank you so much. And thank you so much, Jeff, for agreeing to be part of this
Always, yeah,
crazy
this means so
episode, just
much.
loaded with dick jokes because it's what Cynthia would have wanted. So, as Jeff and I spoke about, Cynthia refused to bring her original artworks to New York for her first exhibition. In a lot of cases, the originals were lost anyway. Like the original Jimi Hendrix, as we mentioned, fell apart. And she'd just gone through way too much with Herb to ever trust anyone with her originals again.
I could see that.
Instead, she had silicone molds made of each cast, which new pieces were made from specifically for this show. Cynthia was very protective of her work, refusing to have any replicas made unless she was present and requiring the molds to be destroyed. For a long time, she was iffy about selling her art. Considering the nature of her work, you can imagine the legal issues that might have cropped up. But in the summer of 2002, Cynthia began selling limited edition copies, both on their own and as sets, like Guitarists or the Curved Collection. The proceeds went to the Cynthia P. Castor Foundation, a nonprofit she set up to help Chicago artists in need. Cynthia always had a very complicated relationship with her mother. Cynthia often struggled. Her mom was very harsh, but she was generous and often helped her daughter out. Still, their relationship wasn't good. When asked why she didn't want to tell mom about her art, she'd say, quote, "I can't afford a bodyguard," implying the warden would come after her. But Cynthia was always indebted to the warden in some way. She felt a lot of guilt about that. In the late 90s, Cynthia started writing a book. She went through a few working titles, Done Dick, Plastercaster, and Plaster of Paradise. For one reason or another, these plans were put on hold.
Cynthia was a beloved lifelong Chicagoan. She was something of a local celebrity. She even ran for mayor in 2011 as member of the Heart Party. I love all these
I have a
puns.
photo of her campaign buttons somewhere. There we go. Of course, Cynthia Plastercaster, the Hard Party. Erect Cynthia Plastercaster for mayor. And my personal favorite, Cynthia Plastercaster, hard on crime. She had a great sense of humor.
She truly did. She had a collection of phallic-shaped things, even a giant Oscar Mayer weenie balloon. Her home was her studio and gallery. She ate, lived, and slept amongst her babies. When she invited friends for sleepovers, they were proud to sleep amongst her penises. She felt most comfortable transporting her babies in her purse or a basket. She loved making Christmas cards every year. They'd often incorporate her babies somehow. She drank her red wine with ice and a straw, loved Thai food, and grew flowers on her balcony every summer. She attended her friends' movie nights until she was too sick to. She was known for her vibrant personality. She was very particular about who did her hair and how it was done. For a long time, it was bright red. She loved getting pedicures at Laura Zimone's salon with her friend Babette. Of course, Cynthia would be telling her stories and dick jokes to the manicurists. I love that. They loved her. Speaking to the LA Times about selling her work, she said, quote, "I will never retire. As long as there are talented people who have appendages, I'm there." Cynthia periodically exhibited her work through the 2000s and 2010s, but as her health worsened, her artistic output slowed. The last two casts she made were of singer-songwriter Jan Terry in 2013 and Leah's Sayuri of Fat White Family in 2014. On April 21st of 2022, Cynthia Plastercaster passed away at the age of 74. Shortly before her passing, she donated her coveted Jimi Hendrix cast to the Icelandic Phallological Museum, the world's largest museum of penises. All of her original casts, drawing papers, and concert tickets were entrusted to the Kinsey Institute for Research in Sex, Gender, and Reproduction at Indiana University. Kinsey curator Rebecca Fasman said, quote, "I knew about Cynthia from the time I was a teenager. I went to art school in Chicago, and she was already an incredibly well-respected and adored artist and music lover. Knowing that we are charged with preserving her legacy for decades to come is such an honor to all of us at the Institute, and to me personally." Kinsey is currently working on digitalizing her entire collection. A Jimmy copy was gifted to Pamela DeBar, who Cynthia asked to finish her book for her. We really hope Miss P follows through. We were very fortunate to have access to Cynthia's writing, but we'd love to read more about her life. More of her vast collection of casts, copies, and prints have been slowly distributed amongst her friends and beloved participants over the years. When the Music Box Theater renovation project began in early 2024, John Connor came up with the idea to buy Cynthia a memorial seat. Members of the Friends of Cynthia Plastercaster Facebook group, others who were close to her, and even one of us happily donated to the GoFundMe campaign. Cynthia's groovy antics live on in the cartoons and movies fictionalized Plastercasters were featured in, like John Connor's The Grasshopper and Miley Cyrus's character in Driveaway Dolls. Her bright heart lives on in the hearts of friends and fans like us.
I mentioned the Wayne and Dennis story in MC5, A Brief History, and I really think it's such a shame that Cynthia's little run-in with the Five hasn't made it into any of the books about them, or any of the books they wrote, or the films, because it's so emblematic of a place and time that's never gonna come back. Mm-hmm. Even though Cynthia was so open about her artistic process, and pretty much laid out exactly how to cast a penis, I don't think there's ever gonna be another true Plastercaster.
I don't think so either. It's interesting how time has progressed and people are so much more open about their sex life, yet I don't think artists and rock stars would do this nowadays. But maybe it was the special something that Cynthia had, and if someone else would have tried it, it would have failed.
People loved her. It was her personality.
I can see why.
Was endearing, and the professionalism certainly helped, but if it was anybody else in the uniform, I don't think this idea would have made it as far as it did.
Me neither.
And I did donate to the theater seat. I saw the campaign and I was like, I have to. She needs to be able to watch her movies forever.
I love that.
So back when Cynthia passed, I wrote a eulogy of sorts for her, and I'd like to end this episode with some of the words I wrote then. I feel they bear even more weight given everything we've learned about her today. In the later half of her career, Cynthia called herself a recovering groupie. But what does that mean exactly? It implies being a groupie is something you can recover from, like the stomach bug that kept you home from school. From my limited perspective, I don't feel being a groupie is something you ever truly recover from. I think you're born with it. Either you love rock and roll and rock musicians like groupies do, or you don't. You can't run from it, and you can't really rescind it. Just like Cynthia, I was attracted to the sequins and the crooners and the guitar-wielding titans before I knew what rock and roll was. One day, you become aware of the bug you've always had. I'd have loved to ask Cynthia that big question. Were you born with it, too? As much as Cynthia's art worshipped rock and roll, it also humanized the gods, brought them down to our level. Let's be frank, there's nothing more human than genitals. Her art cemented a place for groupies in rock and roll history, for women in art, and for rock and roll in art history. Cynthia Plastercaster was a rare intersection of a true old school rock and roll groupie and an artist, a creator serious enough about her craft to legitimize it, but joyous enough to see the humor and fun. She was the duality between female artist and female fan. She was one of the very few living links to a bygone era, now joined with the greats in death. Not only was she a daring artist and riotously funny, she was a genuine person, and those are a dying breed. Insert terrible pun about breaking the mold here. We love you, Cynthia. I hope your memorial is longer than it is wide.
That's spot on.
Thanks for tuning in to this season finale of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life of Cynthia Plastercaster.
As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
Don't forget to put all your questions up on our Instagram so that we can answer them for you in the next episode.
Yes.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.
I don't know whether Abby will listen to this back, but now that it's just you and me, I would like you to just make sure to show Abby a lot of love, because she put so much work into that episode, and I hope she doesn't cut that out because she feels humbled. Don't be. You did such a great job, Abby. This episode is amazing. You put in so much work, and we should really all acknowledge that and thank you for this. Now I don't know what else to say.